that gives us a good discussion, that makes people excited, and so on and so forth. So for those who don't know, tonight's meeting is done a little differently. It's actually a call for presentations. Now, a presentation for tonight, which nobody actually followed the directions on, was supposed to be one-page PDF that we got by Monday.
Okay.
No, everything I said there disqualified most people. So we actually did receive five PDFs or six PNGs from someone, but whatever. Regardless, the point of it was we had a really good thread several months ago that Drew started, where she's asking about what are the hacks you use, you know, in the technical sense. And I thought the threads and the irrelevant tangents that might have been attached to it were very, very, very good. There's a lot of stupid, interesting stuff that people do day to day that you don't think about. There might be a three-line script that you run or something you throw in your Croncat file or whatever that other people would get something out of. That might save someone a couple minutes a day. That might save someone manually doing something on a regular basis. Lots of things come to mind, but the approach, to be honest, I was thinking personally that doesn't actually reflect people's day. Was essentially you've got, you know, hundreds of Unix commands, thousands of Unix commands, and the ports and blah, blah, blah. It's like, what do you do that most people don't do that saves some time or makes you, notifies you of certain things or does whatever outside of the normal parameters of a single app? That's really what I was looking at. Nevertheless, let's see how it goes tonight. We do have five people tonight who do have their little presentations. Again, not everybody did one-page PDF, but nevertheless, let's see how far we go. If we want to divide it up and say, hey, let's push it off to next month, there was too much discussion on such and such a topic, like grass, of course, then we'll push it off to the next meeting for January. We're still not sure what the next meeting for January is. We'll let people know. There's a couple possibilities, but it's open right now. As mentioned before, it's also on the website. BSD Certification Group is going to be having two events on Sunday, February 7th. It is a Sunday, anybody? Anybody know somebody's birthday, maybe? Okay. There's the SME session, which again is the subject matter expert, where you go, you review the questions, and so on and so forth. You assess the questions, how relevant they are, how good they are, whether they reflect the tone and the thrust of the BSD certification's aims, and so on and so forth. A bunch of people in this room were actually at them before. Highly recommended. It's a blast of the time. Also, that day will be another BSD certification exam. Again, highly recommend people check it out. Jim, at some point, hopefully at the end of the meeting, can actually tell us what happened to the surveys. Anything? No final results tally or anything, right?
No results tally, but I can speak to them.
Okay. Just one second then. That's the BSD cert stuff. BSD CAN, they actually put out a call for proposals already, I believe. But it's going to be the May 13th and 14th with the tutorials and two preceding days. That is in Ottawa, Canada. I'll say the conference that really followed up from the old BSD Con that was on the West Coast. It's essentially taking a role as a free BSD developers conference that happens beforehand and so on and so forth. Also, if anybody checked the website in the past 4 days, it looks like we got hit by forum spam, but we didn't. Usenix posted like all their meetings for next year. So Usenix, which is kind of funny because it's like a long listing, I know. But Usenix is, you know, I'd say one of the models for NiceBug from the beginning for a number of us was actually the early model of what Usenix was, especially. Kind of, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, this model of an organization, very free, very open, very organic, not too much structure, very much hitting what technical people were talking about, not what vendors were talking about, not what sales engineers were talking about, things like that. That's really, I think, to a large extent, what the model we were looking at. But anyway, they have a whole number of their conferences all for next year posted online. I highly recommend you check them out. ATC this year is in Boston also, on the East Coast as opposed to the West Coast. Jim, do you want to say a couple words about the survey?
Yeah.
Because it's a big deal. Tell what it is.
Okay, so we just completed a survey for the BSD professional exam.
We held it open for an extra month. Actually, it was supposed to open for 1 month, so we held it open for another month. Just closed. We had this time we were able to track how many people started the survey and also how many people completed the survey. So we got an idea of whether or not it was too complicated or not. There were over 3,000 people who attempted the survey. There were only 122 who got all the way through to the end. So it wasn't that difficult. It only took about 20 minutes, but I can understand people being rushed, especially this time of year, and not being able to go all the way through. So we had out of all the questions, we had the majority of answers seemed to indicate that people wanted to have a lab and an exam in their lab, that comparison, or that combination. There was a couple of other questions that were kind of interesting. One was, where do you live? And again, we had participation from, I would say, well over 20 different countries, majority being the U.S., actually Russian Federation, whatever it's called. They had a large contingent. Ukraine came in strongly, and a couple of countries in Europe came in strongly as well. So again, a pretty large global representation for these teams. So that was really encouraging. Standard profile for the number for the age group, peaking at about 30, 35, and trailing off into the mid-50s. And we definitely had a large number of people that were very interested in getting out some comments. We had probably, I would say we have at least 300 comments, spread throughout the whole thing. So it's going to be a challenge, again, to pull the survey results together, but we hope to have a report out by the end of the year on the survey results. Look for that.
Thanks, Mark.
So again, we have a number of people. I don't even remember what their topics were. Mark is going to start on G-Label, though. Previously, Geom, this substance and stuff. So, Mark, do you want to get up here and start? And I think the way to simplify it, first of all, if you want to use the mic, you can use the mic.
Oh, it was on.
But I'll do the slide progression.
Sounds like a recipe for disaster.
So just tell me next page and I'll know what to do.
Yeah, sure.
Hello, everyone.
Can you hear me okay?
Do you want the microphone?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one way to sit down.
Good evening, everyone. Is it on?
Yes. No, you turned it off.
Sure. One mic.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes.
So my name is Mark Saad, and I work for the About Group, which is part of the New York Times.
You have to sit down.
Sit down, sorry.
Or be a little to the side, maybe? Or you can stand up and I'll move.
Sorry.
Give me the next one. And my topic today is fun with G-Label. And for those of you who don't know, G supports labeling of devices. And so at the About Group, we have a problem with HP servers that we use. The devices that show up for the disks enumerate strangely. And periodically, you'll have disks that enumerate as 84, 86, 87, for no reason. There's no 80 in the box. And one of the reasons why this is a problem for us is we use a server management system that likes templating files when we deploy them. So our solution was to use Geom's G-Label utility. And what this allows us to do is to put arbitrary labels on a device. So we can take this device that's dev 86 and we can turn it into something that is dev label rootfs, or so on and so forth. And it allows for an easy way for us to remember which disk corresponds to which particular operation or slice or what have you. So here's a quick overview of how we use it. So typically we jumpstart servers using the standard FreeBSD jumpstart method, and we have a slight problem with glabel, and that it has to be done in single user mode before the disk is ever mounted rewrite. So after the box has completed its initial jump start, we boot it in single user mode, and we run the following command, so you can see in the first gray box, which is geom label, our arbitrary label name, and our first one is rootfs, and that would be for slash in our case, and then whatever the slash geom provider happens to be. In our case, in this example, it's 84S1A. And as you follow along, you can see that we have a label for swap, var, user, and then user 01. It's just an arbitrary label. And after that, we would then edit our SEFS tab to show corresponding entries. And so we changed our entry on line 1 in the second gray box from dev 84S1A to dev label rootfs. So now when another system administrator comes along and they say, well, where is that? They can use the glabel command to print out all the labels and know which physical device it corresponds to. And they don't really have to be overly concerned of why is it, you know, 86 or why is it, you know, DA12, which happens to be sometimes. And for whatever reason, this caused a lot of confusion with us early on. And it makes our deployments easier. It makes the second, third level system administrators view the servers a lot easier. It just makes everything a little happier. But you can use geom in a number of different ways, geom's glabel in a number of different ways. There is an automatic labeling that happens now in 7.2 and newer, where file systems are labeled kind of automatically on boot. So you'll have a dev UFS ID and then a GUID marking. And so you can also use those in place of putting manual labels on, like I did in this example. And that's pretty much it. Go to the next slide. So, you know, just a conclusion, it allows for us to flexibly put arbitrary labels across geom providers, and it allows us to use our final provisioning tool that's going to lay down templated files on top of things in SE with a little more ease. So we don't have to determine, you know, what is our root disk and what is going to be our database volume and that sort of thing. And it also helps with servers that have, you know, funky RAID controllers that decide when you remove a volume, it wants to re-enumerate every device in there. So, you know, your root disk went from being DA0 to being DA2. You know, your box is going to want to reboot. So that's it. Anybody got any questions?
I do have a suggestion, actually. I have add glabel to my logon script so that, especially for newbies that come on, that as soon as they log in, they're reminded where things are.
Yeah, I didn't thought of that.
What was the question?
It was a statement. Adding glabel to the logon script so that someone who's new to the company logs in, they'll see everything that's glabeled just as a reminder until they get used to it.
Well, the output DF glabel type, I mean, what's the point of what you're going to show?
Well, so the thing is that the question was, would adding glabels, you know, standard printout for all the devices help like a new user when they log in? And in my particular scenario, it doesn't, because we, for the most part, have standardized on labeling names. And, you know, one of the reasons why we use dev label as opposed to like dev UFS and some kind of arbitrary name, which you can do with NewFS or TunaFS, is that you have this one problem is you can't label swap in the same way. There's no dev swap something. So if you use dev label, all of the label names are somewhat uniform. And, you know, for the most part, it seems like we're going against the grain in terms of the way FreeBSD wants things to be done. You know, they kind of have this whole methodology of dev file system and a label name. So there's like a dev riser fs bottom one, something that name, dev ms dos, whatever. But using dev label for us is just easy and flat.
Now just to interject for a little bit, I think actually what you're doing, especially with what FreeBSD does these days with dev UFS, dev riser FS, I think what you're doing with labels actually makes a ton of sense, because once you start to be very specific about the type of file system that is installed, that's really good on one level, but on the level of like the system administrator, you want to be able to say, well, this is my root, this is my swap, this is my whatever. And labels are a really great way to say that, at least within an organization. So you are, through the use of glabel, you're allowed to map the one into the other, and so you can accommodate both sides of the equation. And I think that's really cool.
Thank you very much.
It's standardization.
Any other questions? Yeah,
absolutely.
I see a question in the back.
Yep. This is a BFP loop. Does this work all the way from loader up?
It does. So the label itself is actually stored in the last sector of the disk. and the loader can be told to mount root from, and you can say an actual device label.
The loader knows how to do it, it all works.
It does. And this has worked for 6.2 and up. Not tried it on 6.1 and below. I don't know. The support, I believe, is there. I just don't know how well it works or if it works well. And the one caveat here is that while Geon things can be stacked, you know, you can G-label something and then you can G-mirror something, there have been reports that stacking G-label with certain other Geon providers doesn't work well all the time. You know, there are some corner cases where it breaks and, you know, you're stuck. So, you know, it's in the more exotic sense, you know, if you wanted to G-label the two sides of your mirror and then G-mirror them together, probably want to try it first before you roll it out and see how well it works, because it'll probably break.
It's using encryption on top of G-mirror, things like that.
I thought the
one thing is that, you know, I know a lot of it, they'll have, with SATA drives, it'll be AD4 and AD6 for the onboard SATA. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
My understanding was that because 0123 referred to the IDE. Not that I know what happened to 5, but
That could be, and, you know, I also suspected that it was, like, more modern systems have SATA CD-ROMs, and maybe those are eating up, you know, AD0. I know in particular, like, the DL320S, which is like a big storage box from HP, I believe it has 8 different SATA ports inside of it, and I have no idea how they actually enumerate, because every time we get one, we just put a different RAID card in there, because the first person who looked at it said it was too annoying to deal with. But those types of boxes that have all these different SATA ports, depending on which ultimate controller is controlling them, I think they just enumerate somewhat erratically, you know, and it's kind of hard to tell, you know, which physical disk corresponds to which actual device name. So it helps be able to label them and then put a little sticky on the front to know exactly which disk is which volume label.
Well, even in the question with NFS too, because anybody ever jumps into a network picture where, you know, oh well, we didn't know that was an export, you know. So anyway.
Question in the back.
Can we just go back to the mirroring labeling question?
Sure. So
you're saying that if you label two drives and then you mirror them, that's something that has some problems?
There's some sporadic reports, and I haven't followed them too closely, but
can you label a mirror after it's mirrored?
Yes, but labels mirrored have had problems in 8, some of the release candidates, and, you know, I don't remember in 7.2 what the status of this was. I think it did not work for me when I tried it, but, you know, exactly why, I couldn't tell you. It may be a matter of where the label scribbled on the actual metadata portion of the disk, that one of the other providers is overwriting it, something along those lines. But you would end up with a situation where, you know, you either would get an error of, like, the operation is not permitted for whatever reason. One of the things that all the Geon user space utilities do before they actually write their metadata to disk is check to see if they can open that last sector. And if they can't do that, they all just error out saying, you know, operation not supported or operation not permitted or something along those lines, you know, metadata unwritable. And so there may be a conflict in terms of, you know, you may have to label and then reboot and then go back to single user and then mirror. You know, it may just be slightly annoying in that way because of the way all the programs check to see if they can get that last sector of the disk open. Any other questions?
All right, this is it. You're kind of setting up our lighting.
So my tools are all pretty much user land tools, sort of things that I had to hold up just
in this keyboard.
So my user only environment.
Hold on a second.
Sorry.
Has that
joke
on never.
Okay, so I mean everybody has like their own problems.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
So this is Fionn, by the way.
So everyone has their own prompts, right? I mean, it's almost like that's one of the people have a lot of that's in the prompts. So I just put my prompts up just to kind of get out of the way. But if you like two level prompts, one level prompt, doesn't really matter. It's up to you. The only two things I wanted to point out about my prompt that I thought were kind of helpful was the first smiley face. That it, every time a previous process returns a zero, I'll get a smiley face, and every time it returns a non-zero, it'll return this like bold thing, which is. It's just really simple, but it's actually really helpful because I mean, how do you usually know unless you do like semicolon echo dollar sign question mark if the previous command actually succeeded, it doesn't report an error.
I use ESH and it tells me.
There you go. Okay, so this works in corn shell and bash. So if you're using ESH, just keep on using that. The next thing is the, a lot of you might be familiar, that's just the epoch, seconds from epoch. It's just a timestamp. I just don't like to use long timestamps in my prompts since real estate or whatever. So, and if you look back over time, you can only tell how long a job ran. You can tell what you were doing at what time of the day. Really helpful stuff that's often I never seem to use them for some reason. I'm not sure when we why. So, the next thing is this run for command. It took me, like, I don't know, there's probably somebody else that wrote this exactly the same thing, but I wasn't able to find it built by default on, at least on. My environment, I honestly didn't look too close on the BSD environment, but it's just basically, it's a Perl script that just has an alarm in it, so it executes whatever command you want to give after it in a certain amount of time, and then it just exits after a certain amount of time. So you can, I ran into a lot where SSH to a box, and in my environment, they have Kerberos SSH or SAP SSH, or whatever you want to call it. So you can SSH all over the place, you don't have to ask, print a password or anything, just takes care of it. But you know, if you have keys or whatever, you can do the same thing. But with run for command, sometimes you've got SSH in a box and maybe you have a file system issue or some other weird thing and just hangs for, or you know, maybe it's just off the network or something, just hangs. And now you turn this across thousands of boxes and you know, you're hanging 30 seconds, a minute or whatever on each one. And really find really like a way to change this SSH really to have it actually just time out. So I wrote this wrapper script that just is like a Perl wrapper that just run that, you just say run for the done amount of seconds you want to time out in, and then the command after that. And then it works for a lot of things. And it's one of those very simple commands that you end up just using a lot for other things too. I'm a real big fan of this method. So. Okay, this command I just came across, this RL wrap thing. I mean, you guys have heard of it, but it's cool because it adds readline to any sort of interactive script you might be using. You always come across a script that you run it up and then you type your command, you error it, you miss a letter in it, and then you try to bring it up, you hit the up arrow or something like that, try and bring it back, and it just
emacs.
So, what this does is this allows you to add that functionality into it if it doesn't have readline built into it. So, you run an RL wrap and then space the command, and then when it prompts you, you can do stuff like look at history and, I can't remember if it's more like Emacs bindings and stuff, but I think it does.
Comment. No, it covers all that shit. I never have a problem with Emacs. Ever.
Well, if this actually supports Emacs bindings in this, but so you can do like control A and control B. Okay, then the last one, scaffolds. This is a script that it just basically, most of this script is just in the module, so it's really not me at all. But I just kind of took the output and made it into a nicer format. The module does just you just load an object in Perl and then you add just numbers to that over and over, and then it prints out. Averages. So,
how similar is that to MRTG, RID tool?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably output this to MRTG tool and then you could run graphs off of it. But, I mean, the thing about this thing is that it handles like calculating all that stuff. So
that's what RID tool is for.
Oh, it calculates like
dump-ins or totals or whatever, you have lots of stuff.
Correlations.
And then it prints it out in a way that MRC can handle it.
Okay. The org did it itself.
Anyway, the module is called Descriptive Statistics for module. What this thing does is that, you know, you pipe, as you can tell, it's pretty small, but you basically pipe some sort of column of numbers to the script, and then as it goes through, it'll print out updated averages. So if you do it just a one-off, you got everything already printed out, or you can look up a command and have it.
I can't read it, and I'm close, so I hope that I'm not the only one around here. But the averages that you print out, so like, you know, uptime prints out varied averages. You have your like 5 minute, 15 minute,
yeah.
1 minute averages. Are the averages there in like multiple? Thank you, George. Is it one average? And if it is one average, then how is it measured? Just from run to run?
No, average is just like a general term for like medians. Modes, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But like you, I mean, like the window of the
app. Yeah, from start to finish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, that's it. Cool. All right. Next we have Brian.
Woohoo! All right, so
give me one
do I have to sit down?
It would be helpful.
Okay.
No, actually, you don't have to sit down. You just have to walk. Sit on the side if you stand over here without the chair.
Can you shrink that down so it can be seen?
Yeah, I am working on it.
Good. All right. So, Graph is awesome, and that's how I'm going to start this thing. I've been using Graph for about a decade, maybe a little more. It's not something that a lot of people know about, which is a goddamn shame, because it serves many people's purposes very well. I like to say that Graph gives potency to Unix, in that Unix has a path system. You know, you put a path in your shell. But that runs afoul of managing packages as individual packages. You know, you either have to have some external system that has a manifest of what the package contains in order to keep track of it constantly, to be able to uninstall it, reinstall it, run multiple versions of it, and so on. The Graph takes a very simple approach, a very Unix-y approach, in my opinion. What it does is extraordinarily easy. It kind of builds off the idea of configure, and you don't need configure scripts, you know, autoconf, to make Graph happen, but it does work very well with that. The idea is that when you run configure, you give it a static prefix, and the prefix is going to be the name of the package plus the version. However you want to define the version, Graph really doesn't care, it's all a picture Graph. And you give it this standard prefix, like, say, /packages, and when you run configure, it decides that everything's going to live in /packages/foo/dash/version, and installs everything there, and that package itself just expects to find things there. And that would be great and all, except for the fact that when you're in Unix, you're expected to use a path. And so you can't necessarily find what you're looking for because it's living in some arbitrary directory that is outside of your path, and you don't necessarily want to have to add like bazillions of directories to your path. I mean, like, part of the cool things about Unix is that you're allowed to, that you can just put stuff in your path and it's automatically found. So Graph solves that in a very simple fashion. All it does is when you install a package from Graph, it sets up a sibling farm between some target directory and the package directory. So when, for instance, I install some, like, let's say sendmail 8. I don't know what sendmail is up to these days. 9, maybe? But I'm installing sendmail, and I put it in SendMail 8.5.3. And that's great and all. It's all isolated, and I can handle it that way. But when I use Graph, I say graph-i sendmail 8.5.3, and it knows where I put it because I've configured Graph to know where to look for its directories. And then it sets up symlinks into all the regular directories, like user local or whatever you have in your path, and this is all configurable. So that when I say sendmail, sendmail launches out of its package plus version directory, or however I specify it. It's very simple, but it's incredibly powerful. I first got into Graph, like I said, about a decade or so ago. And the reason that I got into it was as a sysadmin, where I had to maintain multiple versions of specific applications. And I didn't want to necessarily have to overwrite the previous version of the application. Like, God forbid, I had to do a rollback. Like, I installed whatever version of Emacs, and my users don't like it. So now I have to roll back Emacs. That's a fucking pain in the ass. It's a huge pain in the ass to do that. With Graph, I'm able to say .configure prefix / packages Emacs 18.9.3, and it puts everything that Emacs cares about in that directory. Emacs knows to look in that directory to find the files that it cares about. And then I say graph-i Emacs-18.9.3. Then it sets up these symlink farms. And the symlink farm is, it just means that when I type Emacs, it launches Emacs 18.9.3. Great. That's exactly what I wanted. And if that version of Emacs has a problem, then I just uninstall it with a graph command. The files don't go anywhere. They still live where they were living. And I'm able to roll it back to a previous version. Just graph-d, graph-i. I graph-d, the current version. I graph-i, the version that was previously working. And that allows me to maintain, upgrade, and roll back packages. And that's how I really got into the idea of Graph, because I had to do a lot of this in some previous jobs. I had to maintain multiple versions of packages. I had to make sure that I could install them, roll them back across multiple machines in a trivial fashion because, humans, we're not very good at some kind of bookkeeping, and Graph was able to just automate it in a reasonable fashion.
So it's basically a way to take source and put it in its own little port system.
Yeah, effectively. I mean, it's like Yum in some ways, except for the fact that it never overwrites what you previously installed.
Yeah.
But whatever. I mean, ports are the same way. When you type make install on a port, it installs it into a directory, and you've lost everything about the previous version when you've installed it. And that is not good, because if I need to roll back, now I have to jump through some hoops.
What do you mean you lost? What do you lose?
So, like, if I go into user ports, editors, Emacs, in ports, and I type make install, it'll install it. But what the fuck happens when that version of Emacs is not acceptable to my users? Now I have to regress. And how do I regress trivially in such a fashion that I can make sure that everything works? And this is really the thing about Graph.
Port downgrade?
These days, yes. Not so much so back in, a couple of years ago, frankly. And, frankly, nothing really works as well as far as I can tell. I mean, not that Graph doesn't have its problems. It does. But for the most part, it's a very simple, easy-to-understand system, and that's what gives it the power that it has, because you, as a system administrator, are able to go, yes.
You didn't clarify, the symlinks are being made on a per-file basis?
Yes. Yes. They do. One of the things about Graph is that it does not symlink directories. It creates them and then symlinks the files, and only the files within the directories.
So basically, you have a proxy directory which is part of your path, and then all of the files from a particular version are getting symlinked into that.
Yes,
proxy
that is exactly correct.
So this is not production safe because you have no way of having more than one version.
No, you do. Well, yes, that's true, and this is one of the problems of Graph. So, like, for instance, where I'm working now, we have this issue where we use asterisk, And asterisk 1.2 is totally acceptable for a lot of the shit that we do, but it's not acceptable for some of the stuff that we do. But at the same time, asterisk 1.6 is a complete piece of garbage, and we don't want to put that on the systems that run perfectly fine with asterisk 1.2. Graph cannot handle that situation. It cannot. It has no facility.
This also doesn't really handle dependencies between packages.
That is correct. It's not a package system. It's not a package.
I don't mean that. I mean, if you're going to build something against that includes libraries that you're also managing this way, there isn't really a good way to manage those dependencies.
You can't track the dependencies. That's totally correct. That is 100% correct. You cannot track those dependencies. And like I said, Graph isn't perfect. What I like about it most of anything is that it's extremely simple. I like simple things. They're very easy to understand, and where they apply very well. So it's not the best system for anything you're trying to do, but it is very good for a certain subset of common problems. Yes?
This is designed for path only or any directory you want, including libraries and programs.
It will, effectively, what Graph does is you configure it with effectively two variables. There are more, but we don't have to go into them. You have a package directory, which is where you give, which is the prefix to your configure. And you have the target directory, which is what ends up in your path. And I'm simplifying this because I think it makes it easier. So what it does is, when you say graph-i, some package, and again, it's an opaque string, it really doesn't care. All it does is, it looks through every file in that package directory and symlinks it into the appropriate directory in the target. And so, in some ways, it's a way of just handling the SAF problem in Unix, and I'm sure all of us who have dealt with multiple packages, multiple versions of packages in Unix, have this problem where we want it to run this thing or that thing. Graph is just a simple way of handling it. And there's really not much more to it past that, but that one simple mechanism allows for some pretty extensive system knitting. I mean, again, it's not perfect, but it does allow you to keep track of things, you know?
It's a great developer's tool. Like I know what you guys do.
Well, as I was going to say, I started into Graph as a sysadmin because I had multiple machines that I had to administer through CFEngine, and I was using Graph to make sure that I could install a specific package, and when that package didn't work, I could downgrade it trivially, and Graph does allow that, really easily. That said, it's been in the last 2 to 5 years where I've really been using Graph in another level too. I started as a sysadmin and then I ended up as a developer using Graph where, for instance these days, I spend a lot of time working on eJeopardy, which is a, XFTP server. I'm sure I've talked to pretty much all of you about these things. One of the issues is it's an open source server that I have to apply hacks to, and then I submit my patches to the maintainers of that source. And one of the things that you have to make sure of within the system is that you can cleanly upgrade from one version to another. And as a developer who has to do those kinds of things, I find Graph extremely advantageous because what I'm allowed to do is install one version in this one directory and then just use one simple command to make sure that that's the installed version. And then once I'm done with that command, I set up all the state data that I need to set up. And then when I'm done, and I need to make sure that it upgrades cleanly, I install another version in another directory. And then I use Graph to make sure that the commands that I run are going to be appropriately run for the current version that I care about. And that means that I can say, all right, here's how it used to look. And I'm going to set up all the data that I care about and make sure it upgrades cleanly from this previous data. And then I'm going to run Graph, and I'm going to run this command again. And when I run this command again, if it all works out, great. But as developers, we, and probably as sysadmins too, God knows I had enough of this problem when I was a sysadmin, things don't work cleanly. But especially as a developer, things really don't work cleanly, and it's my responsibility to fix those things up. So the worst thing in the world for me, and especially when you have modules that depend on source versions that are in, spread across a bunch of multiple application platforms, it gets complicated. So if I was really anal retentive about installing my software correctly and making sure that it could upgrade correctly, then I could always type my configure scripts correctly and make sure that all the flags were set correctly. And when I ran the upgrade, it would work or not work. And then I could go through and run, I could check out the previous version of the commit, because I'm assuming everything is in some kind of source control, which is not always applicable. I would check out the previous version of the commit, and then I would set up the data again, and then I would check out the next version of the commit that I wanted to make sure it could upgrade to, which had some new version that of code that I had written, and then it would, and then I'd install it, and then I'd try to make sure it would upgrade. And all this stuff is very error prone. There's a lot of independent variables that, unless you're really, really, really careful, they don't come together. Graph takes you away from that. What it allows you to do is say, okay, I have this version of this software, I'm going to put it here, I'm going to run this one command, this one command only, and it's going to put it there forever. And then when I want to go and upgrade the software and make sure that what I'm upgrading will transparently move one version of the software to the other without any problems, I run this one other command, and that's all I have to do. And as a developer, that is extremely, extremely important, because I make lots of mistakes, like probably just about anybody who sysadmins or develops, you know. Software is complicated, and software relies on lots of independent variables that are controlled through lots of different means. Graph is a way of taking all those independent variables, wrapping them up into a single local point, and then saying, I will use this, I will use that, I will use that. When I use Graph to reinstall my software after I make a mistake in my upgrade process, I say graph-d, some previous version of software, graph-i, the one that I want to upgrade from. I make my changes in my local repository. I type make install. I type graph-i, my new version. Does it work? Maybe. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, graph-d, start over again. And it's really, really easy. So like I was saying, it started with me as a sysadmin because I needed to run, be able to conveniently, easily downgrade software that I installed when it didn't work. But it ended up with me as a developer going, I need to make sure that moving between these versions works okay. And without Graph, there are many steps involved. With Graph, there are only two.
It sounds like this is great for when you really need to be tunnel, like have a tunnel vision with like focusing on a particular functionality or package. Or is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, like I said, it's not a full package system.
That's true.
It's extremely simple. The mechanism behind Graph is nothing more than a similar bar. And that's all it is. But this really simple mechanic allows for extreme expressivity. You know, it's not, you don't have to do any work to speak of. And not every piece of software out there these days uses configure, but most of them do. And it takes really good advantage of that. So you're not looking at a lot of steps, you're not looking at a lot of complication. It's just a way of keeping all of these software versions side by side and then installing or deinstalling whatever one you see fit for whatever circumstance that you're in. And because it's so simple, it's nothing more than a simling farm.
Sure.
Because it's so simple, you can understand how the system will work when you finally run it. There is no black magic here. None.
Cool. Other questions, comments? Fine. Thank you. So I kept looking at you.
Oh, that's what that means.
XPV.
God damn it. I am using
my left hand. Yes, yes, you want. So bad.
In fact, it shrieked my hands off.
All right, just get it. Just leave it right where it
is. I touched type on that thing.
I stopped my hand.
Hi, I'm Bill Totman. Been in New York about a year and a half, literally working on the street at a security vendor. When I used to work in web hosting, we'd log into one box and then access all the web servers and whatnot. And in that environment, I learned about Scream, where you can have multiple windows within one terminal. And I find it extremely convenient to use because, you know, instead of opening multiple windows or going Alt F2, Alt F3, Alt F4, etc., so that you can do multiple things while waiting for something that's either in another window or you just need more information instead of, you know, just whatever. So Scream helps with that. Here's just some simple things. I don't like the default setter in Scream. I usually delete the etc screen rc in Linux or use a local etc screen rc and just do my own because I changed the default control key. The default control key is Control A. And I like using that Emacs binding to go to the beginning of the line. So that, and I use the Dvorak keyboard layout, so I mapped some different ones. And instead of something something, I use Control T. I use Control T, Control V, and Control D. Now, I list them here as TT and DD and GG. That's because it's escape, space, caret, etc. And with the Dvorak, it's T, V, and G. So it's all in the right hand, and I hold control with the left hand. And what that allows me to do is I set all of my root logins to Control V. My main login, like say I'm going to my home computer and I have a file server I'm going to log into. My home computer I use, home machine I use Control T, and then any user, normal users on, or non-root users, I use Control G. And that just takes a little bit away from them, but that's not a problem. Now, beyond that, here you actually have three nested screen sessions. You have Control T going on here, Control V here, Control V is a root session, and there's all kinds of colors there, and that's all set up by the HAR status. If you've ever looked at the screen RC file, it's like trying to figure out term cap, and it's very specialized. And having said that, I have more a resource later you can check out. And real quick, this is, who doesn't use Bash regularly? Okay. We'll use
ZSH is better than Bash. Fuck off.
I've heard all kinds of nice things about ZSH.
It's actually SH compatible, unlike Bash.
What do you use, Oka?
KSH.
Also SH compatible, unlike Bash.
Could you just take one step back? What was the point of having different escape sequences for different types of users?
Okay, so say I log into my home machine, my laptop that I access my file server with as root, and I remotely log in as root to my other to my file server, and I want to launch Scream. Well, I lose my control. The base, my local root screen session is going to take all the controls, and I can't control the screen session in the remote host. So I log in locally as Bill. And add start a screen session, remote into another box as another user, and then start up a root session there, and I can start a third screen session. It's so that I can control the multiple screen, the nesting of the screen sessions. You have to change the controls variables.
Scroll down a little bit, just to the bottom of this. No, let's get down. No, up, I'm sorry. Okay, good. All right, PS variable. And I don't know if KSH or ZSH has PS1 variables. There's actually three of them. The second one you might have seen. I've never seen the third, and I forgot what it does. I don't even bother with it. With the PS variable, screen hard status can show you where you are. It can show you different windows or screen windows that you have
within a screen session. But the PS variable, you can do all kinds of things with. You can change colors, you can show your path, you can show the exit status of your last command. Is that where you control it, your PS1 variable? You can say how many jobs are running. And so you got a lot of creativity there, and it might be overwhelming, but I do how many jobs are running. I actually have a line that goes across 80 characters wide, just for reference.
72 is correct.
Well, I'm going to change that. And I had a host name, so I know where I am. The time, which, funny, I don't even look at. I look up elsewhere. And then a path that I'm in. And then my command line. So actually, I have three lines for my PS1 variable. And so here I have one command, just an ID, who I am, then just to give you an idea of it kind of wastes real estate up and down, but it's the way I like it. So in any case, this is my root one. It's all, I try to keep it red so that I know that I am root in that window or in that session, so that I don't screw up something. Any questions so far?
Well, why do you have a preference for using screen over just all panels?
Like multiple windows, or it's just,
I can't hear you.
All
kept
one, all kept
three.
It's just kind of
like. It's quicker, less hand movement. That's the main things. And I can do more than 10 different screen windows if I wanted to.
I think one thing about it's cool is you can leave a session and come back to it.
Exactly. I can disconnect a session.
Detach.
I can detach a session and come right back to it. And I often do. So I can, if I'm logged into FreeBSD running screen, I can, you know, be compiling something, disconnect, go to work, come back, reconnect, see how it's going, if it, you know, it's on the machine. Anyway.
Detach, watch. Sorry.
But really, That's the main thing. Screen allows you to continuously be logged in and doing something, or just have multiple sessions that you want to continue later on while you're essentially logged out.
Watch session. I think watching
boots
though.
Huh?
Just need a boot for watch. Yeah. Interactive. Yeah. So this you can do shared scenario. Users.
Oh yeah. You can do a lot of things with screen that I won't even get into. So if you want to get really creative and silly with PS1 variables, you can go ahead and scroll on down. You can even set up silly, you know, ASIC art with Mario jumping there.
That's porn, isn't it?
All right, I have a lot more about this and the specific examples of the PS1 variables and some variables that are used for the colors. I've mapped them all out that are available and in screen as well. Those colors also at BillTopman.com. Any questions? Yes.
Not kind of this is a replacement for screen, but what I used to do was really, I thought really handy is when you're doing Alt-F2, Alt-F3, you can actually promote that to mount, have it attached to a remote host, so you get the actual root prompt of the remote host. So if you work on a box, a secondary development box that you use all the time, you know, until you actually get that root prompt at that box.
I didn't know you could do that. that's pretty neat. That's something that could be helpful in definitely a data center environment.
Anything else?
Just an aside, is there, have you looked at TMUX at all?
No, never heard of it. TMUX? TMUX?
Terminal multiplexer. It's a screen replacement.
Oh, okay. Yes.
You can look at it.
Thanks. Any other suggestions?
Can you run a nice key to map as your escape, because lots of programs don't bother finding it, because the typical thing on a shell is it just redraws the screen. So using Control L is a usually safe of escape key.
I actually use it there. That's a good point, Dave. It is on the right hand for DeWorak as well.
Yeah, I recently faced the screen of TMOC School Aid, and I found the back tick to be the most useful command key.
Hey, come on now, I never, that's even better. I can move control G then and still have full functionality then. Maybe bracket will work. Anything else? Excellent. All right, thanks, y'all.
All right, now we have one of the exception people. You see, Bill's the only guy that did one page PDF on Monday. Maybe you want to do
that.
Hold on.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus Christ. It's meant for elves or something.
Eats like that. It. Is that your contribution for the next?
We're trying to do your PNGs.
Oh yeah.
I don't have GQ View. What do people use? GQ View, Firefox, whatever else. All right. What?
File.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to escape out of the thing. No, it's frozen up all over.
There's no need to open the first one. Don't even open it.
Wow, was it F11? How do you do F11 on this? F10? Yeah, apparently, yeah. the last person to speak is Ike, who sent me PNG files about 4 o'clock today. But I just wanted to make it clear that the whole theme of the idea of giving back to the community for the holiday season, that was actually Bill's idea. Just want to be clear on that, just in case he lawyer calls me or anything. So,
Lager. Okay, Lager. So Lager is really, really stupid. Everybody else has given some pretty like cool big stuff. And actually, Peoria actually gave a bunch of really cool little things. So that's a bunch of stuff. Mine's like the smallest with the most pages. The Lager. Okay. So in the first, let me see. This is an example. Actually, can you open up the next page? How do you do that?
Got me.
Just take it out of the full screen mode. That's too fancy.
Where's F11?
Oh.
I
tried to escape. Yeah.
I started doing that a couple times at this point. Hold on.
Control O.
Yeah. Open up the third one. Fourth one. Yeah. We'll just cut to the chase. Cut to the chase because you were. So in one shell, pop open, this is just like an example of use. In one shell, we're just, tailing var log messages. Woo-hoo, not exciting.
Woo!
Here is the big action line. I'm echoing this little string, hello, Ike. I'm piping it to logger. Back to that first shell, we were tailing, ta-da! Var log messages, just got a nice message with my host name, with my machine, my username, the process ID, and the message that I gave. Voila! Like, totally not rocket science, not interesting, super, super handy, super simple. If you open up the next slide, anybody have any questions? Yes.
Did you want to go to different syslog sources with Logger?
No. If you want to do that, you actually have to open up and start talking with syslog and start doing stuff. And my new boss just slapped gaming tools on me, so maybe doing multi-log and all kinds of other fun.
DJB's doing our next meeting also.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so no, you cannot. This tool is stupid simple, which to me is its biggest strength, because then I will make stuff that the people I work with don't know what it is. This one, here's like a super kooky ad hoc example. So I'm going to do a build world. Where do I do it? Make build world. Here's that command. So in a one-liner, just sitting there like, I'm going to build world and I want to log, and I want to know how long this lasted, and I want the log to do something. Gee, I echo something. I do a lot of echoing to logger just because it's stupid. You can also echo output to logger, of course. But anyways, that's just a pretty simple one. And if I read through the script line at the end with my little Ike note, personal syntax, I just do that all over, and little log notes and things, well then gee, I'll get those two lines at least. And I can see how long it took to build world. Can you go to the next one real quick?
Cupolo?
Yeah.
What are we, six?
I guess. All right, so, an example of a shell script. I mean, you could do all kinds of stuff. I'm going to do like a stupid sync pseudocode rsync thing. Here's an action line. Dude, rsyncing something. I could say, hey, I started. Time. Cool. You just do this into a log real quick. Say, tomorrow I message you real fast. If condition, then blah, 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 some conditions, some stuff. Hey, if I get this condition, say something to logger. Like, if I'm looking for something and it's not there, I want to make sure this thing changed, that I, no changes every day, and it didn't, throw that in the log file. Ta-da, you can do that. This is like really, really stupid, simple examples. And you can also say you've finished.
Hey,
there's one more.
Seven.
Is that it? Yeah. Okay, so just another one last other thing. So piping the output on a jailing host. They're always talking about jailing and the stuff. This is a tremendously stupid, simple thing. It's nice on a jailing host. The output of JLS just gives you your list of all your running jails. So if you have some kind of accounting system, like jails is, you have to account for what's running somehow. So you have a hardware box that's just housed, and you're trying to figure out in a large jailed environment exactly what systems were actually running just a moment ago on that jail host. And say your accounting system somehow marked, or however you were dealing with managing what jails are running on, what virtual machines are running on, what hosts, and blah, blah, blah. Well, at least you have this kind of stupid record dumping to Farlog messages as, every minute. It's that simple, right? So within a certain amount of accuracy, these jail systems were up on this machine without cost analysis.
The idea is that syslog was cheap.
I mean, it's really, really cheap. Yeah, and you get all this functionality, and Farlog messages is already in rotate. Your log rotate, like out of the box, like all kinds of things that you don't have to worry about. You can use and abuse this until, kingdom come, and it's never been mean. So that's it. That's the big advertisement there. And if you want to do anything more complicated, Mark brought up like logging to a specific log file and doing more interesting things with this. The man page for syslog is where you go next, and that's what the man page for logger says. Yeah.
Can you set facilities for log?
Facilities as in syslogs?
Yes. Yes, you can set facilities.
Yes.
And level.
And level. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. Those are two things you can do. Yes.
You can. Yeah. Very useful.
But that's, again, based on my, the use patterns right there, I just throw this at everything. That's way more complicated than I want to think about. But yeah, sure. I mean, at that point, I would almost argue in certain cases to actually do something more sophisticated.
Dish T, dish S.
Do it.
Oh, you can break it up and have the whole remote logging.
That's it.
So, just quick poll. Good concept for meetings, or?
Yeah.
Work?
Yeah.
We're going to vote on what was the, I'm just kidding.
Are these files going to be available on the site?
There's no reason why not, absolutely, right? Everybody's cool with that?
Can we get them all down to one page?
In PDF and one page by Monday? No, probably not. But
George, I think your original concept is the right one, though. One page, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, it's funny because Ike was like, well, can you just put the man page or blogger on a PDF for me? And I was like, no, it was actually, my first thought was, my second thought was, I'm disappointed at it. Because again, I mean, my original conception for the meeting, to be honest, was that, you know, you've got your 100 unit tools. Don't tell me I use this package in, you know, for this port. Tell me what you're doing and piping and doing in simple scripts that's saving time. Ike kind of did that. I mean, people had different approaches to answering the same question, which is fine, and it was good the way we did it, but, you know, so, I mean, how many people were using Logger before today?
That's a
decent number of people in the meeting. I mean, I use Logger in a completely different way. I mean, I actually throw it in the middle of scripts and say, you know, log-t, I'll do something in capital letters, and I'll say, okay, you know, kernel starting to update, this or that's happening, this is done. But that's how I actually use the JLS piping Logger is great. It's completely idiotic. It's great, you know?
Yeah. Simple.
Let's use it a PS1 variable.
Oh, you bitch. Anyway, so I think, you know, that was awesome. Good engineer. It's actually now 6 years of Nice Bug this month. We had an informal meeting. It was a few people in Karma on 2nd Avenue, or 1st Avenue in Manhattan, getting together. But our first official public meeting was at the Linux Expo in 2004 in January. But our first get-together was actually in the middle of the month in December. So, good tradition. Let's keep it up.
All right.
Yay!
Cool. Yay. Have a drink, Mark?
Heavily.
Drink, clean up.
Yeah.